Hey, folks, thank you for becoming a member of Cafe Insider. In addition to the new Cafe Insider podcast, we're sharing bonus material from my interviews on Stay Tuned with Preet. This is exclusively for you. Hope you enjoy it.
Hi there.
Hi, Samantha. Finally. Thanks for doing this. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. Thank you for doing
Congratulations on the book.
Well, you know the feeling. I'm just glad it's done. And I'm well, I was about to say I have my life back, but that's for about 5 minutes.
Yeah. Well, I looked at your touring schedule, and I was exhausted counting up to 30.
The planning fallacy, as my husband says. I get all this behavioral science thrown back at me, but apparently I've made some pretty typical human errors in planning this tour.
No, but it'll be great.
You know, it's a weird time. I posted is one of my favorite scenes where I show up at the White House. This didn't happen very often, but and have dinner with President Obama and the First Lady and a group of their friends with Cass. And as I'm just leaving the kind of cocktail part, my dad calls and he's trying to feed my daughter. And I'm desperate to try to explain to him where the stored milk is. She's less than 1 year old right. At that time. And the temperature of the contretemps between me and my dad rises as he can't understand how to put the thing in the bottle. And I'm at the White House, like trying to go to dinner. And anyway, Obama comes up behind me and says, let me talk to him, and and takes over the negotiation. So that was great. And then pulls me aside after and offers me the job of UN ambassador. And so then I describe going back over every boyfriend I'd ever dated and all of my bad habits when I was a kid and being completely terrified that I was going to be pilloried.
That's some interesting
vetting. Basically, it's like the whole book, it like tries to humanize, you know, things that from the outside just like, oh, she was named UN ambassador and she goes and becomes UN ambassador. But it tries to open up all of that and be like you know, some of what you've done, you know, just talking about the backstory and peeling the curtain back in a way that people don't usually see. So trying to do that, make it accessible. My basic theory of the case, without having ever articulated, would have been, don't write a memoir until you've brokered Middle East peace. you know, kind of who are you to? And so, but the reason I did it the way I did and ended up writing not only a memoir, but a very, very personal, open, vulnerable book is, I mean, so many of the most amazing members of my team have unfortunately left in the last few years. And then so you may say, well, what does that have to do with writing a memoir? But I think that, you know, when you look at somebody who's been an attorney general or who's been UN ambassador and you're a young person starting out and wondering if you can make your way, you might just think, well, I can't necessarily do that. I mean, how am I going to be UN ambassador? That's so rarefied. But if you tell the story along the way for someone, they may see themselves more easily in your, you know, misbegotten youth or in all of the doubts that you might have had at different career crossroads along the way. And so in the spirit of peeling the curtain back on what it's actually like in the room where it happens, but also, you know, how life is lived forward, which is when you don't know what the outcomes are going to be and you have a huge amount of uncertainty about whether you can do what you set out to do, I thought that would be a more accessible way of drawing people to various causes. I mean, whether you happen to care about human rights internationally or homelessness and, you know, the lack of gun control makes you crazy, I think there are lessons in trying to be an idealist in a messy world that are applicable.
Can I ask a dumb question? Was there ever any consideration given, I don't know if it's ever happened before, to declining the Nobel Peace Prize?
If there was, I was not privy to that. I would guess that
I mean, out of modesty, right? I mean, because you would have been able to say, look, this is a wonderful honor. I'm not yet deserving.
Well, that's what he said at the before he got into all this profundity about the human condition. He began it by saying, effectively, like, I'm up here. This is an award given.
Maybe term two. Maybe the second term.
To have given, I mean, and what they said was,
come see me in 5 years.
That was that, and really, and just like the point I was making before about, you know, what's the scoreboard? You know, I mean, it's not as if we know that Barack Obama has a lot of confidence and is sometimes accused of being immodest and so forth. He's fully capable of acknowledging when he has done something well, but that was just a stage in his presidency where the disconnect between getting the prize of prizes and just even the paucity of opportunity he had even had to make the kind of difference that he sought. He was the only one with that job, you know, and right now Donald Trump is the only person with that job. I mean, it is the headiest, hardest, and the field that he is seeing is so different than my field of vision. And whether that's because he's just been out campaigning and is just much more in touch, for example, with how exhausted the American people, a good part of the American people, are by the economic recession back in the day, or because he actually knows the world leaders that I'm asking him to call up, you know, to try to get into a coalition about Ebola, and he just knows who they are and their motivations. I mean,
you persuaded me that he is not all Spock.
He's not Spock. He's not Spock. No.
The thing that got me about him, it's a minor thing that made me think he was unusual, was the day after he got elected, the news media said he went to the gym.
Seriously.
That's like one day. If there's one day you can skip, it's the day after you become the president, you know, get elected president of the United States. And it made me feel bad all those days, which were most days I skipped.
Yes.
Because, you know, I'm a little bit busy. At the time, I was working for Senator Schumer. And, you know, I have a brief to read.
Anything.
Can't go
Sports
to the
Center.
Gym.
Can't go to the gym.
Exactly. Oh, the game went extra innings.
Can't go to the gym.
When you went to Dublin to have meetings, did you stay 3 hours away? Or did you try to stay close to Dublin?
Say that one more time.
I'll do it again. My joke may be a little too subtle.
I may be too thick. Go ahead.
When you had official meetings, if you ever had any in Dublin, did you stay nearby? Or did you just stay clear across the country like Mike Pence?
Oh, you know, I traveling was something I had to be very selective about doing. And I really wanted to go to Ireland while I was UN ambassador, but I didn't. And so I didn't have those official meetings. I didn't thus have to make choices like the vice president made.
You have to make those difficult choices of stay down the street or 3 hours away.
Exactly. But I did travel an awful lot, but I tended to go to places that were conflict areas or places where refugees were fleeing to, in part because the UN is a vital, if flawed, tool for dealing with humanitarian emergencies. And so the more I could learn out in the world about how people were experiencing conflict, about how the UN may or may not have been misfiring in its programs, or certainly how the Security Council was failing to resolve a conflict, you know, that was precious. That was gold to bring firsthand experiences back to the UN, which can be a pretty antiseptic place, you know, kind of timeless. There are these debates that just go on. You sometimes feel like people are reading talking points that they've dusted off from the Cold War, practically.
Yeah.
But to shake things up and to actually say, no, this is actually, I just talked to an individual who told me this about what a chemical weapons attack was like. That was powerful. I tell the story in the book of Aung San Suu Kyi, who was an idol to me, as she was to millions of other people. But when I met with her, I was stunned at how cold she was when it came to the plight of the Rohingya people who subsequently have been subjected to genocide. And I was struck. I was like, wait, is it possible that she cares passionately about human rights but doesn't actually care that much about these humans? And you know, this is just a really important thing to keep in mind, is how do you disaggregate the abstractions and make it about the individuals who are depending on sometimes social safety nets, sometimes distant decision makers to bear them in mind, and whose voices don't naturally make their way into the halls of power. So to me, the book is a story about what you learn and how you grow and try to keep growing. And that includes being critical of yourself and certainly of the system when you and individually and you collectively screw up, and maintaining that self-awareness and that, as you said, that roaring doubt. Because if you ever get confident that you know how, you've got the answer. You know, we've seen through history where that ends. But at our worst, we're immensely short-term focused, transactional, and we just use it as a punching bag when we, the United States, let's say, or we collectively can't get our acts together. Right. It's a very convenient punching bag for that, because it also has in it many non-democratic nations, and they carry weight that allows us then to ridicule the institution. But when we have our act together, when we're pursuing something on behalf of common cause, like an end to the Ebola epidemic or even the Paris Climate Treaty, however limited that would have been in its impact, we can make things happen at the UN, and that's somehow what we're going to have to get back to. Through committees, as you say, through rulemaking, through other things, they come together and they decide, what are we going to do about the Ebola epidemic today? What are we going to do about climate change today? What are we going to do about, you know, the fact that they're committing mass sexual violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo today? You could say that those questions would be posed irrespective of whether you had a global organization. But I think it would be extremely likely that most countries, given especially now in our new media environment, our sort of more breathless media environment than we've had ever in our lifetimes, would punt or just say those problems don't really matter to us in the here and now. And so the UN is predicated on a kind of an idea that it's like a global ATM, that you put money into the system, and even though it doesn't advance your community or your country's immediate interests, that you are as a planet kind of structurally better off when you have less conflict, less disease, more girls' education. Yet it sort of acknowledges about human nature that we don't trust ourselves to deal with those problems as they come, but rather have to kind of chain ourselves to the mast and make yearly contributions that are then dispersed to deal with a set of challenges that don't seem to make an immediate difference necessarily in an American's life, but that over time will advance not only the common good, but also America's welfare, you know, through creating new markets and more stability and less conflict and so forth. But I also learned it from journalism. You know, that's what I did before, of just listening to people, trying to empathize, but also trying to keep my readers in mind. You know, what interests them? What's their perspective? How do I bridge what I'm hearing in Zimbabwe or in Sudan with, you know, the people I know and that I've grown up with in Atlanta, Georgia? You know, how do I bridge those distances? So that's a lot of what diplomacy is about. A tension long ago written about by people like Reinhold Niebuhr and many others long before that, but fundamentally, there's not a threat or a challenge really on this earth right now that doesn't cross a border. That means that we need an organization to pool resources and mobilize actions from more than one country at one time. So the UN is a great venue for bringing together the key stakeholders in solving the hardest challenges of our time.
I kept you a long time. I appreciate your indulgence.
No, I mean, just cut my bad stuff.
I remember taking a school field trip. You know, I think it was on the honor roll. If you made the honor roll, your reward or punishment, as you will, and I grew up in New Jersey. We took they chartered a bus, and the honor roll kids in high school went and we took a tour of the UN. And it was when people still sent postcards. And uh-huh. I went and got a postcard from a little store inside the UN building. And then I needed to buy some stamps. And I said, I need some stamps. And the guy said, this is what my recollection, the guy said, what country? And I said, this country. And he's like, no, what country? And I'm looking at the guy, and I said, I kept saying this country. And I guess you take the position that the United Nations is not actually a part of, is not actually the United States, right?
Correct. Extraterritorial. Exactly.
I'm like, I know I made honor roll, but I'm not quite as smart as you might think I am. I don't know what this crazy guy is talking about. And I kept saying this country. And rather than say, do you mean the United States? The guy wouldn't humor me.
Oh, my gosh.
He taunted me with being an ignorant America first guy, I guess, back then.
That's amazing.
It is also the place, final thing, when we had relatives visit from India, and, you know, they would visit from time to time, or close friends of my parents, and my parents wanted to show them America. They took them to three places. They took them to Washington, D.C. to see the monuments. They took them to the Niagara Falls. And they took them to New York City. And the two things they would take them to see in New York City, the Statue of Liberty and the UN, which might not have been the thing you would predict that, that immigrants would take someone to.
Like
the
That's
UN
amazing.
Is not as much of a tourist destination spot for lots of folks. But my parents thought it was a very important place to go see.
That's amazing. I wonder, you know, you'd be surprised. I think there's, it's even not for Americans, of course, as you say, but for people who visit New York, I think it really is still, it has managed for all the dents and the bruises and the kind of tattering of the flag. It's still, because it's our, as you say, it's our norms and our ideals. Even without the enforcement, they're all enshrined there. You know what our Constitution is for us. You still have to lay it down, even if we observe in the breach.
Well, thanks again. This is great. Good luck on the book.
Thank you.
Handle
thank
all the
you
cities.
For doing this.
Absolutely.
And sorry it took me so long to get on your show.
No worries at all. I'm glad it actually worked out perfectly.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks so much. Okay. Cheers.
Take care. Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks again for becoming a member of Cafe Insider. Listen to the Cafe Insider podcast every Monday with me and Ann Milgram, and stay tuned every Thursday.